Zobinar is currently a doctoral candidate in the Department of Near Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan. Prior to that, she earned a master's degree at Georgetown, and before that, a bachelor's degree at Tufts. Zobinar.
Well, thank you, Richard, and I would also like to thank Sebu Aslanian for putting this conference together and for the invitation. It's a great honor for me to share my beginning work with you all, and thank you all for coming. I will begin by quickly giving a recap of the historiography of Ottoman Armenians from the perspective of Armenian studies. Within Armenian studies, the politics of the Armenian genocide have set a specific paradigm in the scholarship regarding Ottoman Armenian history in the 19th century. Overall, the largely ethnocentric literature has often implied that subjectivities are linked through ethno-confessional identities. Armenians have been represented as victims and therefore lacking agency. Scholars have concentrated on the literature and sources produced in the Western Ottoman metropolitan cities, such as Izmir and Istanbul. And here I think my critique overlaps very much with Baskin's critique. The Eastern Ottoman provinces, where the majority of Armenians lived, have been told from the vantage point of those residing in Tbilisi or Istanbul. Using sources from metropolitan centers, has also reinforced the perception that relative to Armenians in the Russian Empire and Istanbul, Armenian life in the eastern provinces was backward. The backwardness has been measured against a very Western-centering conception of modernity. Having said that, I have to emphasize and recognize, as our panel shows, that there is a wave of Ottoman-Armenian history that is emerging, that's taking a very different direction. Today, I will present the methodological approaches, sources, and questions that I try to tackle in my dissertation, which is still at its very early stages. So I really look forward to your comments and suggestions and questions. In thinking through the problems of the historiography of Ottoman Armenians, I have benefited from the discussions that have taken place in women's or gender studies. I find many parallels between women's studies and Armenian studies because both are concerned with an interest of a specific group of people and therefore have written the history of that group. Yet the field of women's studies has gone through a much more rigorous questioning of methodological approaches than Armenian studies. In the late 1980s, Joan Scott aptly noted that writing women's history separately from men's history accentuates the difference between the sexes, while the feminist historians aim to do the exact opposite. Similarly, writing a history of Ottoman Armenians separately from Ottoman Muslims essentializes their differences. Joan Scott had noted that when reading texts as evidence of experience, you're bound to reproduce the rigidity of the categories, such as gender, ethnicity, and religion, that are present in the texts and further essentialize those categories. What Scott suggested instead is to look at the literary aspects of the texts and instead try to delineate the processes through which those categories were discursively produced and reinforced. In translating Scott's approach to the Ottoman-Armenian context, I ask how separate singular subjectivities of Armenians, Kurds, and Turks were shaped discursively. How did discourses of Armenian and non-Armenian texts overlap in their discursive strategies, in their use of tropes, and in their overarching goals? Finally, I ask who participated in the constitution of such discourses. And here I'm really going to get into the meat of my research. So to concretize these methodological questions, I approach a methodological approach, and to have us hear the voice of people from the eastern provinces, I would like to read a portion of a petition from 1862 composed by inhabitants of the town of Ardamet, which is southeast of Lake Van. as shown in the map. The petition was addressed to the Armenian Patriarchate in Istanbul and reads as follows. And here's the petition. We, the signatories, who are from Ardamet, borough of Van, humbly dare to announce to you, your sublime holiness, that for a long time the wrongdoer Mahtesi Khachatur of among the wealthy people is doing such evil acts that nobody has read in the book nor seen with one's eyes. Because it is well known that the women of other villages and cities courageously promenade in the mountains and fields without even doubting the uneducated or untamed Kurds, but this unlawful individual, wherever he sees a good-looking woman, he violates them for his own desires, like the unlawful elderlies of Israel towards Shushan. I'm skipping a little bit here. And then they go on saying, when an Armenian realizes such deeds and remains unpunished, then what is to be done with the Kurdish city dwellers who make up 300 households? Since in these times there is no hanging or cutting for such a case, he, not being afraid of punishment or fines, does not stop his evil deeds. The same people of the borough of Ardamet, for their poverty, almost all of us here, we are 150 people, all of us in agreement and unanimous, we complain. In some, the inhabitants of Ardamet had reached Istanbul to complain against an influential person in their community who was accused of causing a lot of trouble for the community. Before I start peeling off the multiple layers of the petition, I would like to briefly locate it in its historical context of Van and the eastern provinces in general that had been under control of the Kurdish emirates for centuries. Since the 1830s, this region faced the increasing intervention of the Ottoman state, which fought against the Kurdish emirates. This led to the reconfiguration and reorganization of local power structures and dynamics. Furthermore, the period between the 1840s and 1870s, which is the era I concentrate on, stood out for the Ottoman reforms known as the Tanzimat. This era is particularly significant as the Ottoman state and the Istanbul Armenian Patriarchate attempted to centralize their power throughout the empire. Furthermore, it was a time of institutional reorganization. The Armenian National Assembly in Istanbul was formed in the 1860s. The structural reorganization impacted the governing bodies and the Ottoman subjects alike. As Judith Butler has argued, subjects regulated by such structures are, by virtue of being subjected to them, formed, defined, and reproduced in accordance with the requirements of those structures. Accordingly, in this era, both Armenian and Ottoman writings were immersed in a discourse of reforms, whereby singular subjectivities were being discursively shaped along ethno-confessional divisions. Yet what I aim to suggest is that while Ottoman Armenian and Ottoman Muslim discourses overlapped, and the type of subjectivities they aimed to mold resembled, the subjectivity of an Ottoman Armenian was to be represented separately from the subjectivity of an Ottoman Muslim subjectivity. Thus, in my collection of petitions, I try to look at what type of subjectivities the petitioners expressed, why and how they expressed it. In the petition I read above, the inhabitants of Ardamet represent Khachatur as a wrongdoer, unlawful and wealthy. The emphasis that Khachatur was one of the wealthy people placed the rich at the bottom of a moral hierarchy. From the beginning, a subject position emerges that highlights a socioeconomic status rather than an ethno-confessional belonging, which delineates the subjectivity among the signatories that stigmatize the rich of their community. In the petition, the accused Khachatur's ethnic identity is not directly linked to him. His name makes it clear that he is an Armenian, but in other petitions, when a non-Armenian, Orthodox, or apostolic individual is accused, such as a Kurd, a Muslim, a Catholic, or a Protestant, their confessional or ethnic identities are always mentioned. Thus, the question remains as to why, when the accused is an Armenian, the ethno-confessional identity is not directly mentioned at the beginning of the petition and in conjunction with the name of the accused. To prove the wrongfulness of Khachatur's acts, the petitioners do not use the legal repertoire or describe more specifically what he has done. Instead, they compare Khachatur's acts to the acts of the elderly Israelites, which refers to the characters in the beginning of the Book of Daniel in the Bible. Secondly, they compare Khachatur's acts to the acts of Kurds. The metaphors to Israelites and Kurds seem to speak stronger than the law. The only time when the petitioners refer to the law is when they refer to Khachatur as being unlawful. They express a consciousness of the importance of being lawful in the eyes of the patriarch. In doing so, they position themselves as law-abiding subjects. But what does the law constitute in their mind? The petitioners laid out the mechanism with which order was to be kept in their community. In the petition, the view looms that male petitioners' inability to maintain order within their own confessional community would hinder possibilities of protecting themselves from outside groups such as the Kurds. According to the petitioners, it was only by keeping the members of the Armenian community in exemplary behavior that they could demand and expect a similar treatment from the Kurds. If the community could not solve its problems from within, then it would be impossible to protect themselves from attacks coming from outside of their communal boundaries, which they define through the adjectives and comparisons that they attribute to Khachatur. With such resolve to protect their community, the petitioners were shaping themselves as subjects committed to their community. By articulating that they stood in agreement and unanimity, they also make sure to emphasize that as a community, they were united. Thus, on the local level, the petitioners seem to perceive themselves as the guardians of order. Therefore, they represent the law. The 150 men pose as the ones responsible to protect their community. For them, preventing attacks on women is a matter of honor and of the security of their entire community of Ardamet. Although women are being attacked, we only hear about a man losing his eyesight because of Khachatur's acts. And this is the portion I didn't read of the petition. As a result of the man's blindness, the woman who depended on him experiences loss. We do not hear how women reacted to the attacks or even what they suffered. We only hear that they reported about the attacks. Thus, the petitioners speak with a strictly masculine subject position and a particular understanding that males of a community are to protect women. Yet, in this case, recognizing that they lacked power, they turned to the legislative body of the patriarch and the institutions he governed. They also infer to a former practice where they could turn to corporal punishments to restore order, but indicate that currently they lack such rights. Accordingly, they demand that the political council and the patriarch in Istanbul provide them with protection. By delimiting their own power and recognizing the legal power of the patriarchate, the petitioners position themselves as political legal entities. In sum, a number of subject positions of the petitioners emerge in this petition. One of a socioeconomic status, a subject of the Armenian community, of protectors of the village of Ardamet, a masculine subject, and a political legal subject. While the subject positions of the petitioners were multiple and sometimes contradicting, they were also participating in a process of shaping an ideal and singular Armenian subjectivity, one that was law-abiding, educated, committed to public good, united with their co-confessionals, and viewed the Kurds as outsiders and as being untamed. These characteristics mostly correspond to the Armenian subjectivity that was being formed in a more public discourse of reform. One example of such a discourse appear in Garakin Cervantian's periodical, Artsvik, sorry, Artvik Darno, that was published between 1863 and 1865. Cervantians, a native of Van, was committed to implementing the Armenian National Constitution in the provinces and was dedicated to the centralization of the Patriarchate, a process that actually Richard Antaramyan greatly lays out in his dissertation. Through his discourse, Cervantians aimed to shape Armenian subjects that were hardworking, committed to improving their communities, and ridding themselves of internal problems. He encouraged Armenians to be educated, obedient to Ottoman law and the state, as well as church regulations. He also called on Armenians to be unified, especially against the uncivilized, untamed, or barbaric Kurd. These characteristics closely match the way in which the above petitioners represented themselves. The connections between the discourse of the petition and Cervantians break down the boundaries of modern and backward. I suggest that the language with which the petitioners strategically represent their subject positions vis-à-vis the Sublime Porte or the Armenian Patriarchate engage them in the process of shaping singular ethno-confessional subjectivities, which were often masculine ones. Besides the connections between the discourses of an Armenian elite and the people in the provinces, Armenian discourses of reform overlapped with Ottoman discourses of reform. One example that brings together both the Ottoman Muslim and Ottoman Armenian discourses resides in a linear perception of progress, whereby the West was identified as advanced relative to Istanbul, and Istanbul was perceived advanced relative to the Ottoman East. Another example is the trope of the savage rebellious Kurd, or the savage other, that appears not only in Ottoman imperial discourses, as discussed by Ottoman historians Usama Makdisi and Selim Deringil, but also in the language of Muslim petitioners from the region of Van, who wrote to the Sublime Porte. And here's a petition. Well, I have not gone through my Ottoman sources as rigorously as my Armenian sources, but the few Ottoman petitions I have examined, there already emerge parallels between the subjectivities that emerge in both Ottoman Armenian and Ottoman Muslim petitions. For example, in this petition from Haydar Agha of Van, signed by a number of other tribal leaders, the petitioners express their subjecthood to Ottoman law and the Tanzimat, but also to their ashiret and to their local traditions. They also position themselves against the rebellious or even savage Kurds through which they express their loyalty to Ottoman state. In conclusion, such overlaps between Ottoman and Armenian discourses of different strata of the society allow delineating how reform and institutional reorganization within the Ottoman Empire precipitated the discursive shaping of specific types of subjectivities among the multi-ethnic population of the Ottoman Empire. Finally, it provides a mechanism with which to write a connected history of the multi-ethnic population of the Ottoman East, even when the discourses of the period aim to draw clear boundaries between the ethno-confessional groups. Thank you very much.